Vetherell was defiant. "And who will decide that? The Honourable High Lords of Terror? By what right, and under what authority? Under the provisions of the Treaty of Olympus, the Titan Legions have never acted under orders from this council, but voluntarily acceded to its many requests. If the Council of Terror will not give Mars the right to decide its own destiny, how long do you think Terror can stand against the War Master without the Mechanicum's assistance?" She gestured to the High Lords. "And how long will you be allowed to behave as if you command the mighty Titans yourselves?"
"Your implied threats do your cause no good," Rantal spat. "Furthermore, they ignore the realities of our situation. Mars has no voice here because Mars belongs to the traitors."
There was uproar in the tiers of the chamber. Tevera and Vetherell exchanged a weary glance. Pentasian rose from his seat.
"Once more we are losing ourselves in recriminations and insults rather than acting for the good of the Imperium. There is one point upon which I will agree with Ambassador Vetherell. The current situation regarding the chain of command is not tenable."
Rantal was startled.
"Surely you don't seek to endorse the creation of their new adeptus?"
he asked.
"Absolutely not. Given that Mars is currently lost to us, I believe we must all accept the fact that the treaty signed between Terra and the Mechanicum cannot be held valid. All of its provisions are nullified. We must act to formalize a new accord and a central authority. Yes, the Collegia Titanica needs a clear chain of command, and that chain should begin here, in the Council of Terra."
"No," Vetherell cried. "You cannot dictate that." She had had enough. She had made one last effort to reason with the Council, but it was pointless. Pentasian and Rantal were lining up to pick over the carcass of the Mechanicum before it was even dead, and the other High Lords were following their lead. She looked to Tevera again and nodded. It was time. Rantal sat up straighter, relishing the meal he imagined was to come.
"Ambassador Vetherell," he addressed her, "as representative of the Mechanicum adepts present on Terra, you will—"
The doors to the chamber flew open. His treads grinding against the polished marble floor, Zagreus Kane entered the political arena. His arms were folded, their mechanical hands held open. He had come without weapons, as was the law, yet his very being was the embodiment of machinic force. His existence was a threat, and Vetherell saw with even greater clarity why he had chosen not to be part of the deliberations until now. His mere presence precipitated crisis. The Collegia Titanica representatives stood as one. Vetherell watched the jolt of realization hit the chamber, the High Lords at the debating table in particular. They were suddenly aware that there was a concerted military force in the midst of their council session, unarmed but still intimidating. At the head of the table, Malkador the Sigilite clambered painfully to his feet and planted his staff squarely on the floor. He called out to Cain as his clanking form reached the dais.
"Think very carefully about your next actions, Zagreus."
"I am taking none,"
the Fabricator General responded flatly. He did not mount the platform, but remained where he was, observer and observed. Tevera turned in her exoskeletal frame to address the tiers above them.
"I am Warmonger Princeps Tevera of the Legio Aggravatis. We have come to be heard. So hear our voices now, and take heed. If the formation of the Adeptus Mechanicus is not approved in this session, then the Collegia Titanica will know where it stands, and we will no longer be the puppets of the Council of Terra. To your eternal shame, you have abandoned sacred Mars, homeworld of my Legio. Now you demand that my comrades forsake their worlds too, to burn undefended beneath the assaults of the traitors. If there is no Adeptus for Mars, there will be no Titans for the throne world. We will abandon the Solar War and return to our own fiefdoms immediately.
The chamber erupted in roars of outrage and condemnation. Council members and observers alike shouted over each other. The noise washed over Vetherell. She and Cain and the princeps stood in silence, unmoving rocks in the sea of anger.
"You have heard us now," Vetherell thought. "But will you listen?"
She guessed not. Har Rantal leapt to his feet. He did not seem so comfortable in confronting the imposing form of the Fabricator General at the edge of the dais, and so he pointed an accusing finger at Vetherell instead.
"This is who you are,"
he practically screamed.
"This is treachery, a coup. I will see you executed for this."
"This is no coup. It is the resolution of an equation," she replied. "We understand the necessity of an Adeptus Mechanicus. If you do not, then you must be shown it in terms you can comprehend. The binary succession must be ended."
Rantal turned to his fellow High Lords.
"Oh, I'm tired of this. Let me call in the arbitrators. I will have the Martians arrested and tried for their crimes against the throne."
The uproar grew louder. Most of the voices cried their approval, but others urged caution, leniency, time to consider all options. They were the ones who saw the line that was about to be crossed. The loyal leader of the Cult Mechanicum and many senior princeps of the Collegia Titanica in chains would be a disaster for Imperial morale across the galaxy. At last, Vetherell knew, some of them were beginning to see the danger. But not enough. And now it was too late. A deep, reverberating impact shook the floor of the chamber, swaying the long lumen sconces hanging from the dome high above. Vetherell and the Titan officers noted it well, but did not react. Another impact, stronger this time, strong enough to be felt in the shudder of the walls. The council delegates in the upper tiers began to glance around at one another in confusion, even as a further tremor shook masonry dust from the ceiling. Then Mars's greatest voice was heard on Terra. The blast of the war horn cut through the din of the chamber, and all who heard it fell silent. The sound came from far away, but it rattled the dome all the same. The bellow was deep yet piercing, redolent of the greatest majesty of war. Another tremor followed it a few moments later. They were drawing nearer. Pentasian's eyes grew wide.
"What is happening?"
he spluttered.
"Ambassador?"
"The Imperator Magnificum Incendius of the Legio Ignatum walks towards us."
Vetherell's words were a simple statement of fact. Their implication, though, was enormous. Rantal stared at her in horror. The war horn sounded again, louder, nearer, and a moment of shocked quiet descended over the chamber. Thousands were holding their breath at once, listening to the approach of the god machine. One of the most colossal engines of war ever built walked with ominous purpose towards the political heart of the Imperium. It had stepped over the defences wrought to protect the master of mankind as if they were not there, and now strode down the wide avenues of the outer palace, driving crowds of fleeing citizens before it. Its huge weapon arms cycled up, rotary barrels the length of maglev trains, plasma accelerators that could drive a starship. The Titan's roar was so loud, it seemed as though that alone could bring the palace tumbling down. Emplacement guns were brought awkwardly to bear, having only been intended to fire outwards from the walls. The Custodian Guard and Imperial Auxilia garrisons tried to outflank it, but this was just one single engine of the Collegia Titanica, and there was currently nothing within 100 kilometres that could halt its relentless advance. Panic took hold of the council chamber. There were no windows. No one could see what was coming, yet the sound was enough. Everyone present knew of the holocaust that an Imperator Titan could unleash upon its foes. Its voice was a howl to shatter the heavens. The end was coming. There was no escape and no recourse. Pentasian scrambled towards Vetherell.
"Stop this! You are commanded to stop!"
She stood her ground.
"Who commands us?"
she asked, timing her words to come between the blasts of the war horn.
"Who commands the Mechanicum? Who commands the Titans? The binary succession is the product both of poor Martian logic and frightful Terran ignorance, and it may prove the death of us all."
the beat of the Titan steps with the rhythm of approaching doom. Vetherell looked at Malkador. The Sigilite was watching her steadily. His face was shadowed, expressionless. He said nothing. He was letting the situation play itself out. Was he so confident there were lines that the Mechanicum and the Collegia Titanica would not cross, Vetherell wondered, or had they already been left far behind? The Ambassador and the Princeps had committed themselves irrevocably. The consequences of this day would be unavoidable. She felt the Sigilite judging her, waiting to see if, once and for all, she was prepared for what she had set in motion.
"Or maybe you approve," Vetherell thought. "Maybe you want this, too."
The blast of the horn overwhelmed the screams in the chamber. People were scrambling over each other to reach the exits from the tiers, fleeing what could not be escaped. But the sound froze them in mid-flight. It was so close, it seemed to come from inside the dome and all around them all at once. In the moment of silence that followed, Vetherell spoke again.
"The binary succession must be resolved. The Adeptus Mechanicus is the resolution. There can only be zero or one. There cannot be both. Otherwise there is uncertainty. With uncertainty, can there ever truly be loyalty?"
She paused.
"And if there is no loyalty?"
The Titan's battle cry came one last time. One more step, and it seemed as though Magnificum Incendius would crush the dome beneath its immense armoured foot. Rantal threw up his hands.
"Enough!"
He stumbled back to the table and sank down into his chair.
"Enough!"
The other High Lords, some of them partway towards the chamber exits, nodded their agreement, looking shrunken and small beside the other men and women of the Council. Vetherell nodded to Tevera, who spoke into her vox-speed.
"Princeps Bassanius, stand down."
Magnificum Incendius halted. The tremors ceased. Even so, Pentasian looked up as if he could see the shadow of the Imperator pressing against the exterior walls of the chamber. His face was ashen.
"We concur with Ambassador Vetherell," he mumbled. "There will be an Adeptus Mechanicus to resolve the specific conflicts of succession within the Martian contingent on Terra."
Malkador spoke then. His tone was hard, unbowed.
"And what does the Mechanicum propose in return? Tell me, Ambassador, do you expect the Council to be held hostage indefinitely? The Adeptus Mechanicus will be a voice on the Council, but it cannot be the only voice."
"Agreed," Rantal growled. "This must never be allowed to happen again."
He was not posturing. He had reached his limit. Vetherell could hear his conviction and his determination. If she pushed him any further, his duty as commander of the Arbitrators would force him to push back. Then the nightmare would truly be unleashed. Malkador nodded slowly, wrapping his staff on the marble floor of the dais.
"There will be conditions. If Fabricator General Zagreus Kane is now to ascend to the ranks of the High Lords, he must permit us some concessions as a gesture of good faith. But we will discuss such things only when the officers of the Titan Legions remove themselves from this chamber."
This was the price that had to be paid now. Kane had to restore trust, and Vetherell's boldness had ensured that the price of that trust would likely be high indeed. Vetherell met with Bassanius and Tevera at the feet of Magnificum Incendius. The Imperator had halted its march barely 100 yards from the walls of the Great Chamber. It stood in the centre of the 2-kilometre-wide avenue of the Imperial Awakening. Its banners flapped in the strong wind. Low clouds tore themselves across the peak of its battlements. The god machine faced towards the chamber, a sentinel once more, but a fearsome one. The thronging crowd in the avenue gave the Titan a wide berth, while Ignatum protector squads stood guard around the bastion-like entrances to its lower legs. At the same time, the adepts and the officials of the palace slowed and gazed upwards at the engine, mesmerized by the source of their recent terror. Bassanius stood with a proprietorial pride before the god-machine, with Tevera beside him. is this what you hoped to achieve, Ambassador? He asked.
The Adeptus Mechanicus is becoming a reality, Vetherell replied. And so is the Adeptus Titanicus. Mars has been promised to us all once more, in exchange for our full-hearted compliance in the defense of Terra now.
But the Titan Legions still have no voice of their own,
Tevera wheezed.
We are enthralled to Zagreus Kane and the alliances he forms for his own purposes.
No, you will have agency through Zagreus Kane. He honors all of the ancient oaths, the old bonds between the priesthood and the loyal commanders of the god machines, and he insists that you be recognized by Terra. This is the oldest alliance, renewed at the Imperium's greatest time of need, and named Adeptus. Vetherell gestured to the great chamber. The council decrees that the Legios must act in defense of the Segmentum Solar, and so they shall. But the nature of the deployment will be under the authority of the Fabricator General. In exchange for this service, he will ensure that the Lesser Forge worlds do not remain undefended. They will be protected and fortified by the Adeptus Mechanicus while the Titans march to war.
Bassanius raised an eyebrow. And what of the Treaty of Olympus? Is it dead?
The treaty...
She stopped, looking off into the direction of the Stellarum Vigil, thinking about the much-needed glimpse of their lost homeworld that she would have in a few hours' time.
The treaty remains in place, though Mars itself does not observe it. I have faith in the Omnissiah, and that we loyal few will take back the Red Planet when the time is right. For now, though, the home of the Adeptus Mechanicus is on Terra.
But what does that mean for us?
It means that the chain of command in the conduct of this war will have a clear order. Neither Mechanicus nor Titanicus can hope to shape the Council's decisions, then ignore them whenever they choose. The decisions we will help to inform are also the ones by which we must abide. It is not the perfect outcome, but I believe it is the best that could be obtained.
The two princeps exchanged a look. Then Tevera turned back to Vetherell.
So, this is our victory?
A victory? The ambassador queried. Against whom? There will be no victory until Horus is defeated. She thought about what had already been lost, what had already been destroyed. I don't think the Imperium will ever have a triumphant victory again. Those days are behind us.
So we gain influence and lose our autonomy, Bassanius sighed. And for what?
The gain is greater than the loss. I do believe this. The binary succession is ended. There is only the Adeptus Mechanicus now, not temporary, but permanent. There shall only ever be but one Fabricator General, and all loyal children of Mars who would hold true to their faith must follow his command for the good of all mankind. Vetherell looked up at the Imperator. It had halted only a step or two from catastrophe. Just as on the Stellarum Vigil, she had been one unlucky blow away from death and failure. The way forward was narrow and shadowed, but they were all embarked upon it now. There was only one path, and it led through the furnace of war.
That was The Binary Succession by David Annandale. Read by Jonathan Keeble.
Perpetual by Dan Abnett. Read by Jonathan Keeble.
They had been living
against their will, in the city on the lip of the cliff for nearly 2 years. 2 years that seemed like 2 centuries to Ol Pearson, which was odd because Ol Pearson was used to the grand passage of time. He was one of the rare ones, one of the mythical beings, a vestigial side branch of the human race that had been born with unique gifts. One of those gifts was functional immortality. Ol was old. He had lived multiple lifetimes, so many that he had forgotten most of them. He had no idea of his actual age any more. A man tended to lose precise count somewhere after his 150th birthday. Ol's best guess was that he was around 45,000 years old, give or take. 2 years was an interlude to one of the perpetuals, a sunny afternoon, a long lunchtime. But not these 2 years. They had dragged out like a hard term, a relentless prison sentence. Frustration did that. Frustration and anxiety. They were lost. They were stuck. Their long, haphazard trek across the wrinkled folds of unspace had brought them to the city, and there the path had run out.
"When are we again?" asked Zybes.
All the members of their little band had become used to framing this odd question. Not where were they, but when.
"I think," Ol replied, "at the tail end of M23.
He glanced at Zybes and knew this answer would need expansion.
"Circa 23,000 AD by the old calendar. The last few centuries of the Dark Age of technology."
"Which is?"
asked Zybes, pausing in the middle of his meal, a heel of bread hoisted to his mouth but forgotten.
"During the long rebellion of the Iron Men," said Cat. "The cataclysm that led to the, Malthusian catastrophe."
"Oh, you remembered," said Ol.
"I listen," she replied, glancing at Zybes. "Not like him. I remember your words, even if I don't really understand what they mean."
At the start of their journey, which had been less of an embarkation and more of a frantic flight from the atrocity at Kalth, Ol's policy had been to tell them very little. The members of his band, Zybes, Cat, Crank, Rain, and the agricultural servitor, Graft, were just survivors. They had not been chosen or called like him. Ol had brought them with him out of pity, because he had a way out of the slaughter, and it seemed cruel to prevent them from sharing it. Moreover, they were humans, mortals, with the exception of the cyborg Graft. Ol had kept truths from them, because he'd been afraid of polluting their brief limited lives with deep-scale information about the universe. That kind of knowledge might wound them on an existential level and drive them to insanity. How could any of them ever return to normal, mortal lives if he shared the immortal things that he knew with them? However, their escape from Kalth had turned into a trek, and the trek had turned into 6 years. 6 years of slicing reality open with a knife and slipping from one now to another. 6 years of their questions. How do you open space with a knife? Where are we going? Who are you? Where are we now? When are we now? In the long run, it had become simpler just to answer them and explain things. They didn't understand most of it, but they nodded sagely at his stories and explanations, grateful at least to be offered some answers. The girl, Cat, brighter than most, remembered. She stored things up in that unusual brain of hers, and could recite back many of the truths that Ol had told them. Ol sometimes wondered why he had decided to answer their questions. To shut them up was the simple explanation. But after a while it had occurred to him that the more they knew, the better they could help him. One day, in an atomic bunker a kilometre beneath the pole of a dead colony world, he had told them the big picture.
"Life hangs in the balance," he had said.
Crank frowned.
"Whose life?"
"Mostly everyone's. What happened on Kalth and what happened to us there, it was part of the End War. A war that could rip our species apart."
"Whose side are we on?"
asked Bale Rain, the young soldier.
"The Emperor's, of course," Graft had whirred. Well, yes, of course, Ol replied. As it happened, Ol Pearson had little time or liking for the thing that men called the Emperor. But that was beside the point, a personal matter. If you didn't stand with the Emperor, you stood with the others, the usurpers. And the usurpers were not creatures that any sane man would want to throw his lot in with. So, yes, they stood with the Emperor. I'm old, Ol had said to them.
We know,
laughed Rain. I mean, I'm older than you can imagine. I wanted no part of this war, I just wanted a quiet life. But I got recruited, roped in.
By who?
Cat asked. A friend of mine. He needs me to go to Terra, so that's where we're going.
Terra?
Gasped the seasoned army veteran, Dogent Crank, amazed.
In all my days, I never dreamed I'd end up there on the throne world. Right. And what do we do when we reach Terra?
Zybes asked. Ol had thought about that. Even though he was being more free with his answers, there were still some that he didn't want to give.
Whatever we can, he muttered.
Okay. The trek had been long and arduous, and perilous, but at the city on the lip of the cliff it had ground to a standstill. The ancient compass that Ol carried, the one that could read the winds of the Empyrean, had stopped working. There was no way to know where to cut next, or what bearing to aim for. They were becalmed, marooned, with no way forward. Sometimes the winds could die down, so at first Ol had presumed it was going to be a minor delay. But days became months, and months became 2 years. They had set up a home in the city, and spent their days wandering the back lanes and alleys, hunting for a spot where the compass might start to twitch again. The city was a deep, meandering place of dark stone. The locals called it Andrioch. It was a human colony from the days of the first stellar exodus, and Ol fancied that it had once been magnificent. But there had been some sort of misadventure, probably due to the technology wars that marred this bleak era of humanity. The dark stone of the city was dark because it was stained, perhaps with soot or by radiation burns. The cliff that the city overhung plunged away into the centre of the world. If you peered down, you could see, through the clouds of vapour, the glow of the magmatic furnace that was the planet's core far below. He thought Andrioch had likely been twice this size once. Half of it looked to have been torn away by whatever created the cliff. There were weapons in the older days that could do that. Weapons of immeasurable power. Tech devices employed by both the Iron Men and the alliances that stood against their cybernetic revolt. Ol remembered the horror of entropic engines that ignited planets, sun snuffers that uncoiled like serpents the size of Saturn's rings, mechnivores ingesting data along with the cities that contained them, and hurling continents into the heavens, omniphage swarms stripping flesh from a billion bones in the blink of an eye. Those were the good old days, when war was something too colossal for a human mind to comprehend. Not like the End War. The War Master's heresy was a smaller thing, scaled for human and post-human brains. But it was bigger in some ways. Yes, bigger than the godlike struggle of the cybernetic revolt. Bigger in scope, bigger in its implications. More horrible because humanity could apprehend it and drive it. Although he did not say so, Ol Pearson believed that a mechnivore had bitten Andrioch in two. A rogue unit, perhaps, though by that latter stage of the revolt almost all machines were rogue, their abominable intelligence querulously hunting for friends but perceiving everything as enemies. The citizens of Andrioch were pale ghosts, like things that had lived in a cave, lacking colour or health or effective eyesight. Their skin was translucent. They did not interact with Ol and his band, but spent their days and nights in the rotting pits of their dwellings, wired into constant data feeds, sutured into their eyes and scalps, feeding off some illusion of normal life while they waited for the mechanicalism to end. For them,
It never would. Their bodies would wither and die, and they would come to exist only as a virtual spectre, the memory of a city stored in a digital gestalt. Ol was determined not to join them. But the trek was dangerous, and he realized that there was another reason he had started answering the questions his band asked him. None of them were ever going to go back to normal lives. He'd been fooling himself. He could tell them anything he liked, because they were never going to rejoin the ordinary again. They would probably die on the path, sooner or later, and if they made it to Terra, as Dogent Crank so fervently wished, they would die there anyway. All had been weak. On balance, it would have been a greater kindness to leave them on Kalth to perish. That was typical of him. Alanius Pearson had always been too merciful for his own good. A bad trait in a soldier, especially a soldier charged with such a vital mission. He sighed, staring into their campfire.
2 years. We can't linger here any longer.
He didn't dare tell the others how worried he was, because then they'd realize there were some questions to which even all the pious didn't know the answer. There was no way forward, no route around. The only way out of Andriok was to go back, to retrace their steps. And John Grammaticus had warned Ol never, ever to do that. Ol wandered the alleys where the city leaned over the cliff. He thought he could see the actual bite marks. He was pretty sure that the cliff itself was the problem. Andriok was the next step in the trek, but they had arrived there too late. The Mechnivore, or whatever other rogue behemoth had preyed on the place, had consumed more than just the physical city and the planetary crust beneath. It had eaten data. Not simply the digital data stored in Andriok's analytic engines, but the raw data of space-time itself. It had bitten away the vital set of imperial coordinates that Ol needed, the cosmic vectors of the Immaterium that his silver compass and little jet pendulum responded to. The hole they had spent 2 years living beside was more than a material hole. It was a wound in the ether, the anti-reality that coexisted with the physical universe. Andriok perched on the edge of a bite mark in the warp. The question was this situation pure misfortune, or something deliberate? He believed the latter. There was no doubt in his mind that agents of the enemy were pursuing them. Indeed, he was sure that they had accumulated several enemies. Demons, word-bearers, seeker legionaries, and the assassins of the Cabal. But this was not a simple hostile threat. Someone had steered them, or influenced them. Someone had tricked them into taking the misstep to Andriok, knowing that they could go no further.
Ol!
He heard someone calling his name. He paid it little heed. His mind was old, and the memory of ancient voices haunted him from time to time. Then he realized it was a real voice.
Ol! Ol!
There! On the black stones of the broken causeway ahead of him, right on the lip of the endless cliff, stood John Grammaticus.
"Bit of a mess," he called out. "Sorry."
Ol clambered up to join him.
"We're stuck here, John. This is a dead end. I know. We've been here 2 years."
John looked aghast.
"Two? Oh, I'm sorry. I've been caught up in things.
Well, the Cabal caught up with me. Again, they're putting me back to work for them. I've been waiting for a moment when their eyes aren't on me so I could reach out to you. I'm sorry it's taken so long."
"So am I."
"They're on to you, too,"
John warned. He was wearing the dress uniform of a photon lancer from the Unification Wars. It was rather too ornamental for Ol's taste, but John's mind had chosen his form and appearance. He wasn't really there. Ol didn't have to reach out and touch the wet nothingness of a psionic projection to know that. John was an ultra-function psyker. This was a telepresent meeting.
"On to us?" asked Ol. "On to you. The others don't matter.
I'm not sure why you brought them along.
Company, said Ol. He knew that John Grammaticus would have little patience for the rationale, because I didn't want them to die.
You're so sentimental, Ol. You should ditch them. You can't take them all the way to Terra anyway. Especially not the girl. She's live.
Touched by the warp, I know.
And untrained, which is worse.
Come on.
You know the only reason you have to go to Terra instead of me is that you're not psi-active. A psyker can't get in undetected. It has to be you.
Okay, okay, let me worry about the girl, said Ol. Explain about the Cabal and how I came to be stuck here.
You're not stuck. You're hiding. I hid you here. They've worked out what you're up to, and they've sent hunters to stop you. That last cut you made, from Ulbanuk to here.
Yeah, I had to steer you. If you'd made the obvious cut, it would have led you through to early colonial Cadia, and the Cabal had a kill team waiting for you there.
All remembered Ulbanuk, and the last stop before Andrioch. A plague cemetery world from the Age of Strife. The compass and pendulum had behaved oddly there. He'd been about to make a cut, but the needle had moved, and he'd made a different cut instead.
That was you?
John nodded.
The best I could manage. I nudged the compass so it would bring you here. Cadia was a trap. I brought you here because there is only one way in or out. It's clear now. Go back to Ulbanuk, then cut through to Cadia. You'll be on your way again.
You told me never to go back.
Well, the rules change, Ol. You have to, this time. This was a hideaway. Somewhere they wouldn't think to look for you.
Because of that,
Ol asked, gesturing to the chasm that yawned beneath the causeway.
Right, because of that. That giant hole of cosmic nothing. Brilliant, eh?
Ol shrugged. John began to lose his patience.
Go back to Ulbanuk, Ol. I'm sorry about the delay here, I really am. Go back, then cut on to Cadia. You're so close now.
Are you sure?
I swear it, Ol. So close. Go back, cut again. You'll be on your way.
Another voice echoed in the gloom.
Who is this you're talking to, Ol?
Ol and John looked around. Cat was picking her way up the causeway towards them, frowning. Ol realized that he had been gone a while. She'd come looking for him.
This is John, he began, then stopped. You can see him.
Yes, silly.
Of course you can, Ol,
said John with a nervous laugh. He tapped his temple with the tip of his index finger.
A psyker, remember? Of course you can see me.
He turned to face the girl.
I was just telling Ol the good news, he said. It's time to get moving again.
Ol went very still. He watched as a handful of pebbles, just tiny flecks of stone, trickled off the causeway and plunged over the edge into the endless drop. They had been dislodged by John's boots as he turned. But John Grammaticus was just a psi projection. He wasn't really there. Ol threw his fist into John's gut. The blow landed solidly. John staggered back and then came clawing at Ol. He was strong. Stronger than any human, stronger than any perpetual. His blow knocked Ol backwards, sprawling. Ol landed at Cat's feet, so dazed that he couldn't clear his head.
"I'll just have to do this here, then,"
said John, in a voice that wasn't John Grammaticus's. There was a bright flash. John was hit in the chest and knocked onto his back. A double pulse from a las pistol. Cat stood with the weapon braced in her hands. She didn't like guns, but she had learned how to use them.
"He isn't your friend, is he?"
she asked. Ol didn't answer. He lunged for John in desperation. Despite the las bolts to his chest, he was picking himself up, so Ol buried the blade of his athane dagger in John's neck. The man spasmed wildly, then fell, his feet twitching. Ol made sure he was dead. It wasn't John. The corpse was too bulky. The falsehood cloak that had been woven around it was failing. Ol and Cat saw what was underneath.
"What is it?"
asked Cat.
"Who was he?"
"An enemy, hunting for us, trying to lure us into a trap."
"He's so big,"
the girl murmured, more afraid now.
What's that tattoo on his collarbone there? Is it a spider?
No, a hydra.
What does that mean?
It means the Alpha Legion is hunting for us, Ol replied. But that, like most of his answers, meant nothing to her. Ol gathered his little band together in the rotting black stone house they had been sharing. "Enemies are coming," he told them. "This place, it's a snare, a dead end. They managed to make us turn the wrong way. They're trying to block us from terror, which means we must be close."
"What do we do, Trooper Pearson?" asked Graft.
"We have to change course. We have to follow the winds a different way for a while, until we can get back on the right bearing again." Rain glanced out of a broken window.
"But we can't go back if it's a trap," he began.
"We can't," Ol agreed. "The hunter had a knife like mine. Well, a little like mine. Cuts the same way. Basically, he was moving the way we move. That's how he found us. He came from Olbanook, on our heels. So that's where they're waiting for us." Zydes shook his head.
"But there is no other direction. You told us this is a dead end. The only way out is back the way we came, and killers are waiting for us there."
Ol took a deep breath.
"There is one other way," he replied.
"It's dangerous. It's extreme. But I think it could work. If you trust me, and you're prepared to risk it. It's the only way, apart from living here for the rest of our lives. And our enemy won't be expecting it. What do you say?"
Crank nodded, trying to look brave.
"We trust you. Well, how dangerous is it?"
asked Zibes.
"I won't lie. Very."
Ol took out his blade.
"But this will get us through. Only special blades can cut through space. They're rare. And this is rarer still. The most special, special blade of all. Blessed and cursed both at once. If anything can get us there, it's this. It can cut more than space."
"Why, what else can it cut?" Rain asked.
"Gods."
They packed and headed out after Ol. He guided them towards the place of departure. He was carrying the knife, but had put away the compass and pendulum for the time being. He wouldn't need them for this. It wasn't going to be a subtle crossing.
"Thank you," he said to Cat as they walked up through the city.
"For what?"
she asked.
"You saved us. I'm getting old. I nearly missed the trick that was being played on me. So thank you. And thank you for reminding me why it was a good idea to bring you all along on this journey."
"Why was it?"
"Because nobody could do this alone."
They reached the edge of the causeway. Below them the cliff fell away into the hole that had been bitten through the world, and through time and space as well.
"What now, Trooper Pearson?" said Graft,
halting at the precipice. Ol smiled.
"We jump."
That was Perpetual by Dan Abnett, read by Jonathan Keeble. The Burden of Loyalty, edited by Laurie Goulding, read by Jonathan Keeble. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2018.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.